Turning to Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 11 and verse 1. Romans 11, verse 1. I say then, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. For I also am an Israelite, of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. The subject is the future of grace. Of course, from the vantage point of the Apostle Paul, from his standpoint, from his time and onward, the course of grace. Israel has rejected God, with the exception of a remnant. They are lost, but a remnant has been saved. For the many, there has been a judicial hardening of the heart. We've been seeing that in the previous chapter. In the meantime, there has been the evangelism of the Gentile world. And this brings us to chapter 11 and the first verse. And I say then, hath God cast away his people? And first of all, in the passage we're going to look at, we see the great faithfulness of our God. Has he cast away his people? The original is perhaps a little more forceful than our English translation. The King James Version is better, I think, here than the more modern versions, who put it more politely. Has God repudiated his people? Has God rejected his people? Has God cast away his people? Is nearer to the original and gets across. Has God pushed them away, shoved them away in disgust and ignominious rejection? Has he done that? Well, look at the verse. I say then, hath God cast away his people? Surely that's impossible, that God should thrust away and utterly reject those who he has made his own, to whom he's given promises and pledges. So you read the question a few times, and the full horror of it comes. A God who will not keep his promises. A God who will be unfaithful. That's what Paul means to express. I say then, with the rejection of the majority of Jews, can it mean, can it be, hath God thrust away his people that belong to him? Would a father and a mother just cast out a young child? Would God be of that, working in that order? God forbid. It cannot be. That is impossible, exclaims the apostle. And then he immediately gives an example. I also am an Israelite. I'm an example of an Israelite not thrust away. And he elaborates of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin, of the very purest extraction, you might suggest. No, that is impossible. Verse 2. God hath not cast away his people, which he foreknew. And we're going to have elaborated to us the faithfulness of God in saving not every single Israelite, not keeping hold of every single Israelite, but in saving and blessing a great number of them. A minority, probably, over all the centuries. Who knows? A remnant, our translations call it, in both the Old and the New Testament. And that is all that God promised to do in the first place. The promise never was that the entire race of Israelites would believe and be safe and be saved. But that God would, well, of course, if it had been down to them, not one single person would have ever walked with God. Not Abraham, not Isaac, not Jacob, none of the patriarchs. None of them would have walked with him had he not drawn them to himself and opened their hearts. The tendency of the human heart by nature, we're a fallen people, is against God. And we never would sincerely, genuinely desire him for his sake. We will never repent of our sin, but for his working in our lives. And the promises to Abraham that he would have an offspring who would believe were always to the people, concerning the people in whose hearts God would do a work, overruling their refusal to have their God. God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. He will be faithful to his promise. And right down the history of the Old Testament and into the New Testament and to the present day, God has continued to save Israelites, Jewish people, in much larger numbers, as the Apostle Paul goes on to indicate, than we realize and that we see. So for the faithfulness of God is established, and how important that is to us. We trust in him, the living God. We believe in Christ. He's moved in our hearts. He's convicted us of our sin. He's shown us the way of salvation. He's drawn us entirely by the Spirit to himself. So we've trusted him, and we've received that new life which comes from above, and we've walked with him. Are we safe? Will God be faithful? Will God hold us and keep us as he undertakes all the way to the end? Of course he will. And his faithfulness is confirmed once again here. The faithfulness of God in the saving of Jewish people, Israelites, down the centuries to the present time and to the end is assured. Not the totality, not the entire race, but a number, a large number, a remnant as it's described, and our own trust in God's faithfulness is assured. And just as that remnant is safe, so we as saved Gentiles are safe in the keeping of God. So verse 2, God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. Wot ye not, don't you know, what the scripture saith of Elijah, how he maketh intercession to God against Israel? Say, you remember what happened to the prophet, very disconsolate, very cast down, under threat of the loss of life. His life would surely be taken. And I won't go into the history and into the background. So he is, in a sense, on the run. And he appeals to God. Has my ministry been in vain? Everything that I've done, I've been given mighty things to do, he might have said. I have been enabled to work miracles, even. Tremendous demonstrations to the people of thy power, he would say to God, and thy goodness. And yet, here they are. They will not turn. There's been no reformation in the land. No turning to God. No appreciation of his mercy and his grace. And I now am on the run, and my life is at stake, and there's nobody left. That was the prophet's feeling. And he says in verse 3, there's a quotation from 1 Kings chapter 19, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, the only one, and they seek my life. And the answer of God was, I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Do you remember there was that experience as Elijah ran miles and miles and miles and many days to Horeb, the place of the covenant originally given to Moses. And he went there and he hid himself in a cave and in his misery. But God, in the meanwhile, gave that tremendous wind which broke the rocks and the earthquake and the fire. But these didn't alter demonstrations of God's power, didn't alter Elijah's feelings. And he reiterated his statement, all is lost and my life is at stake. And that's when he was told this, that there were 7,000 men and many women too and youngsters in the population of Israel who had not bowed the knee to Baal. Tremendous. 7,000. Do you think that's an exact figure? Very likely it's a symbolic figure. 7 in the scripture, that perfect number, is invariably a symbolic figure. 7 with 1,000 added to it, to just convey that it's a very big, perfect, symbolic figure. All the elect of God. And there were many of them. But Elijah didn't realize it, and he didn't know it. In the context of this passage, you and I have no idea just how many Israelites have been saved and are saved. Merged, of course, now in the church, the international Jewish Gentile Church of Jesus Christ, through every land and nation where there are Israelites. And the last day will demonstrate just how many were kept by the Lord and saved. I wonder if it could be said of us that we are among those people who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Are there friends here? And you know the Lord? You've come to him. You have a definite experience of conversion. But you do bow the knee to Baal. You do bow the knee to Baal, watching things that you shouldn't watch on the television. You bow the knee to Baal in various worldly activities and pursuits. I'm going to try to define worldliness on Wednesday. I hope it'll be a help. Can it be said of us, they are among the thousands, the millions that I have even now in this world who have not bowed the knee to Baal and compromised the faith of Jesus Christ? Are you a party goer? Do you love things which are thoroughly worldly? Do you have to hang on to your dose of worldly pleasure because you're not deep enough spiritually and proving the Lord and enjoying him and committed to him? Well, let me move on to this fifth verse. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. The faithfulness of God, even among the Israelites, a remnant. Of course, it always was like that, right from the very beginning. And the apostle is going to prove it in just a moment. But let's read verse 6. If by grace, then it is no more of works. This prepares us for the seventh verse. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. Now, the Israelites were convinced that they were accepted by God because they kept the ceremonial law, or sought to, and particularly the Israelite clergy, meticulous in their keeping of the requirements of the law. And they thought by this means God would be pleased with them. And of course, they were Israelites. You put the fact that we are God's people already next to the fact that we obey him in the ceremonial ritual law, and they were confident and convinced that they were accepted by God. In other words, they were righteous enough. They had sufficient righteousness for the blessing, the everlasting blessing of God. That's what they were convinced of. And so in verse 7, what then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. Well, how does the apostle know that? That Israel, by this meticulous law-keeping and ceremonial, and despite their confidence, has failed to know acceptance by God and to relate to him and have his power. Well, of course, the apostle Paul knew. It was obvious. It was obvious from the words of Christ, who preached to the Jewish people, accept your righteousness, exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, ye shall in no wise, in no case, enter into the kingdom of heaven. What? Our clergy, the scribes and the Pharisees, not entered into the kingdom of heaven? That was the teaching of the Lord, consistently. Woe unto you, scribes, and so on. So he knew it from the teaching of the Lord. He knew it from the failure of the Jewish nation and their occupation by the Roman forces. They were not walking with God and his blessing was no longer upon them. They knew it. Paul knew it because there had been no prophet, no miracle worker sent by God among the Jewish people for 400 or so years. Another indication of their failure to please him and have acceptance with him. And their own character and the character of the clergy and the things they did. And of course they persecuted Paul and sought to murder him as they did to the Lord. So it was obvious that they were not reconciled with God. And he could say then, what then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. And that's actually quite a strong word, seeketh for. They were zealous. Paul has told us that in the previous chapter at the very beginning, that they have a zeal and a passion for acceptance with God, but they're going entirely the wrong way about it. They're self-confident. They think they can achieve it by their own efforts and their own works, and they don't see their sinfulness and their need of God's pardoning grace and their need of a substitute, Jesus Christ, and a Redeemer who'd suffer and die in their place. They hate that kind of teaching. So they're self-confident and self-reliant. And so they are not experiencing acceptance by God. But the election hath obtained it. The people who are brought to appreciate God's mercy and grace and Christ suffering and dying on Calvary, or who trusted in that even before he came. But the election hath obtained it. At the end of verse 7, and this really introduces us to an additional thought, and the rest were blinded. Most modern translations, I notice, say hardened. Hardened is more literal. The Greek has, made like stone. So you'd think that hardened was a better translation than our King James Version, which says blinded. The King James translators obviously were applying the stone-like hardening to the eyes. And so they went for blinded. But they did this, I think, because of the context. Verse 8, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see. And verse 10, let their eyes be darkened that they may not see. They're quotations, of course, from the Old Testament. But to draw the translation into that context, the King James in verse 7 says the rest were blinded, whereas others would translate it hardened. There's no difference as far as we're concerned. There's a great difference, I realise that. But it amounts to the same thing. Judicially hardened by God, so that they just could not see the way of salvation. Of course, they started it. They hardened their hearts. They resisted him. They rejected him. They would not call upon him. They were not thankful to him. They were proud. If we're going to have the favour of God, we're good enough. And they would not listen to their prophets and their teachers. So God, in his term, as a judgment, fixed them in that state. I've seen people fixed in that state. Haven't you? I've known young people brought up in Christian homes. And the years have gone by and they've been keen through the Sunday schools and maybe the Bible classes. And as youngsters do, with good minds, absorbent minds, they seem to have theoretically understood everything. It turned out that they rebelled and they were not safe, but they understood it all. They understood the theory. They knew the teaching. They knew their Bibles. And then you talk to them when, say, they've turned 30, or 35, or 40, and they don't seem to understand anything. And you say, Weren't you the young man, the young woman, that went to Sunday school for years and to Bible class and answered the questions and showed promise and clearly knew the theory, if not the experience? But they hardened their hearts, and they were proud, and they rebelled, and they scoffed, and they scorned, and God took away from them even what they had. Is such a thing as hardening? But it's a judicial act. And what you've got now, if you understand the way of salvation, but you hold away from it, what you've got now, you may not have in 10 years' time, or 20 years' time. You could lose, so to speak, your opportunity. You could be hardened. You cannot insult God forever. You cannot insult him and spurn him and turn him away. Now, happily, it isn't always the end of the matter, because even here we see an amazing instance of the mercy and the kindness, the great kindness of God. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, very strenuously, but in his own way and proudly. But the election, the people who God has determined to save, in spite of themselves, hath obtained it. And the rest were judicially blinded or hardened so they couldn't see the point and their own need and what Christ had done anymore. And then quotations to support this and to demonstrate this. Verse 8, according as it is written, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, apathy, indifference, inability to care, eyes that they should not see, ears that they should not hear, unto this day. Stupor, insensitivity, no comprehension, unwillingness to listen or to turn. It's all quoted from, at least the end of the verse 8 is quoted from Isaiah. But the main quotation is from Psalm 69 and then from verse 9. David said, let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see and bow down their back alway. That's not David saying that. It is, of course. But David in Psalm 69 is under the most bitter persecution and suffering hatred from people who should love God. And it's a messianic psalm. And David's experience is a kind of prophecy of what will happen to Christ. And so David, as a prophet, is speaking God's words, that God will call them to account, all the people who are so against him. And there will be judicial blinding, and hardening. So verse 11, I say then, have they stumbled? Here's the wonderful part. Have they stumbled that they should fall? A person may stumble and fall over. One knee on the ground. They can get up. They're not flat on the ground. One knee, perhaps, and a hand on the ground. And they can struggle up. What's happened to Israel? They've been rejected. Does that mean the entire nation, it's the entire nation that is in view, has fallen entirely? No. The remnant is going to be saved. God forbid. But it's going to be saved in a remarkable way. God forbid, but rather through their fall is come unto the salvation, is come unto the Gentiles. For to provoke them to jealousy, God is going to show mercy on a remnant of Jews, even though the nation has rejected him, even though there's been blindness given to them, even though their hearts have been hardened. It won't be the end. God is going to overrule, in many, many cases, despite all this, the goodness of God. So with many of us, isn't it? So many of us went to great lengths at one time in our lives to reject him and spurn him. And maybe we heard the gospel and people appealed to us and we wouldn't have it. And we were entrenched in our rebellion and our pride and our foolishness and our dreams and our opposition to God. And yes, maybe we were among those who were hardened. But it wasn't the end of the story. Because so great was the mercy of God that we were melted even after that and drawn to him. And that's what God will do to keep his promise to Abraham and his promise about the Israelites. He will save a remnant of them in spite even of hardening. And he'll do it in a strange way. He'll bless the Gentiles. Millions and millions of them from every land and nation, drawn out of every century. Millions will be saved. And the strange way in which God will work, he doesn't save the Gentiles only in order to move the Jews. He wants to save them anyway. But at the same time, he will use the salvation of non-Israelites so as to provoke many Israelites to desire the same. Many Israelites will hate it, as they did in Bible times. This idea of preaching Christ to Gentiles, they hated it. But there were many among them who were moved by it. We know the names of so many in the New Testament, Aquila and Priscilla, and of course a vast number of others who were moved by the preaching of the gospel, even to the Gentiles, and by the apostle of the Gentiles, and they came to Christ. So all over the world, mostly unknown to us and unseen by us, through the salvation of Gentiles, Israelites are coming to the Lord. And that's how God is working. And it's quite remarkable. Verse 11, I say then, have they stumbled that they should altogether fall, all of them, be written off? By no means, God forbid. But rather through their fall, salvation has come to the Gentiles and the Jews are caused to be envious of God's work of grace in hearts. And verse 12, because we have time for this, I'm just going through this morning in a simple expository manner, which is a wonderful passage. But many people say it's hard to understand, and that's right. Verse 12, now if the fall of them, the Jews, be the riches of the world, it's led to the gospel being thrown wide open to the Gentiles, and the diminishing of them, God taking his national blessings away, the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? What does that mean, the riches of the Gentiles? Well, the gospel is preached among the Gentiles, and it means the world is enriched, and of course the Gentiles are greatly enriched. Notice, by the way, that not all Gentiles are saved. We know that perfectly well. Only a minority of Gentiles are saved. And it's going to be the same with the Jews. It'll always be the same with the Gentiles. It'll always be the same with the Jews. The riches of the Gentiles doesn't mean every person is going to be saved. Neither does the riches of the Jews mean, as some people imagine it means, that one day the entire nation is going to be saved. That's a dream. That's a romantic fantasy. I'll explain that a little further. But if the salvation of many, many Gentiles has been to the enrichment of the world, why, compassion comes from Christians, save Gentiles and save Jews. The whole world has been moved to democracy and compassion and sharing and education, and many things which have really all come from the preaching of the gospel to both Jew and Gentile. So there's no doubt about this. The fall of the Jews was the riches of the world, because the gospel came to the Gentiles and saved Jews as well. And just as a byproduct, because our first work is the gospel, the world became, for all its woe and its sinfulness and its wretchedness, it's still a fallen place, but all the good things you can point to in it really came out of the gospel. So the argument of the apostle is going to be this, that if the fall of the Jews, leading to the salvation of many Gentiles, was to the riches of the world, if God goes on saving a remnant of Jews alongside and with the saved Gentiles, how much more that will be to the benefit of the world? Of course it will. The mercy of God. Why should he be speaking about benefits and riches of the world and kindness to the world when it rejects him? The kindness of God. He must judge the world. He must end the world. He must call people to account. And yet at the same time, he shows kindness and compassion all the way. And so should we, by the way, in our lives. Our priority is the gospel, but we're still concerned about good works and compassion, and very much so. But I must hurry because time is racing on. Have they stumbled, verse 11, that they should fall altogether? God forbid. Salvation has come to the Gentiles so that many, many Jewish people in turn may desire the same salvation. Now, if the fall of them be the riches of the world, verse 12, and the diminishing of them the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? Now, some friends look at that word fullness. Their making up of a number, their filling of a number, and they say, oh, there is going to be a magnificent work by which all Jews will one day be saved. But fullness is only describing the total number of Jews who are elect and saved. It may be that before the end of time there will be a remarkable awakening or a revival among Jewish people. It may be. It would be typical of the Lord to take the people who were the most intransigent and resistant of all and cause grace to triumph before the day shall close. But that is not necessarily what is referred to here. How much more their fullness? If there's always been a remnant of Jews saved from the very beginning, it's always been a number, a remnant, all the way through the Old Testament. Ah, says the Apostle Paul, that's going on. There'll be a remnant even through the Gospel age until the fullness is made up and the book is closed and every elect Gentile is saved and every elect Jew is saved. But how much more the blessing and the influence and the compassion and the good if Jews continue to be saved as well as Gentiles. That's the argument. Verse 13. I speak unto you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles. I magnify mine office. I boast in what God has given me to do, says Paul. I don't deserve it at all, but he's given me such a glorious task. There's so much suffering goes with it. But for me, once an enemy of Christ's people, to be given this tremendous task of being the first major evangelist, the apostle, to the Gentiles. Verse 14, this is the way he looks at it. If by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, and might save some of them. It's an important verse. the Apostle Paul says, I long, well, he's told us twice, at the beginning of this chapter, the beginning of the previous chapter, and earlier on, how he longs for the salvation of Israelites. Is he going to tear himself away from being an apostle for the Gentiles and follow the desire of his heart, causing a lot of persecution, and preach exclusively to Jews? No, he will go to Jews directly. He always does. He enters the synagogue in every place he visits, if there's one there, first of all, and then turns to the Gentiles. But no, he's going to stick to being the apostle of the Gentiles because he knows God's plan. And he knows that God is going to use Gentile conversion to draw many Israelites to himself. So he says here, I work for the salvation of Gentiles, and my heart is in it, and I feel for them. But additionally, I have this great comfort that through the salvation of Gentiles, other Israelites will come to the Lord. So it doubles my incentive. That's what he seems to say here. Verse 14, if by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, and might save some of them. The remnant. It's always some of them. Some Gentiles, some Jews. For if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? It's not referring to the end. It's referring to the way in which God will work throughout the gospel age. If Jews continue to be converted, as well as Gentiles, how much more? How wonderful that will be. And look at this, verse 15, I'm going to have to draw to conclusion. If the casting away of them has led to the reconciling of the world, that is the Gentiles, the world refers to them, what shall the receiving of this ongoing remnant of Jewish converts be but life from the dead? Yes, life from the dead. If a Gentile is converted, if I am converted, if you are converted, ignorant people from pagan backgrounds or atheistic backgrounds or whatever, that's wonderful. God changes us. God changes our thinking. Puts a desire for salvation and for forgiveness into us. What a transformation. Turns rebels into disciples. But if a Pharisee is saved, why, that's almost double grace. The Pharisee was doubly dead. He wasn't just a rebel who knew nothing. He's someone who'd heard it all, who was taught from his childhood and knew exactly the work of God. It was almost in his genes. He had full daylight concerning God. And in full daylight, he rejected the word of God and proudly made his own way of salvation. If he is humbled and drawn from his hardened position to salvation, why, the apostle says, it's a double wonder. Life from the dead. It's life from the dead for a Gentile too. But now you can raise your voice and shout it. It's life from the dead. If it's a Pharisee or a scribe or any informed Israelite come to that. And it's true. That's what the apostle means. He's talking of his own experience. He's talking of what happened then, what happens now, before the Lord comes. If the casting away of them be the reconciling of the Gentile world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? They've been hardened, they've been blinded, they're almost double dead. And yet God shows his mercy and saves them. But all the same applies to some of us. Some of us are the same as Israelites in a way, though we are Gentiles perhaps. brought up in Sunday school, passed through Bible class, taught in the family home the things of God, rejected it all, now blinded. Probably not attending church. I can't speak to them anymore. And yet God works. So great is his mercy, and saves them even from judicial blinding and hardening. It's life from the dead. It's double wonder. It's double mercy. It's double kindness. It's double grace. That's the passage. And I must end. Before I close, tell you a little bit about verse 26. But we have to go through the whole passage to get to it. But I'll refer to it in closing. And so all Israel shall be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. Now you'll be aware that many Christian people, good Christian people, think that this is the end of time. The apostle has leapt forward to the coming of the... Why, he says so. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer. Oh, Christ has returned. And at that moment, or just before it, all Israel shall be saved. Great national salvation. Verse doesn't say any of that, actually. The Apostle Paul is summing up. There'll always be a remnant. The remnant in every age, in the Old Testament, through every century of the New Testament, there'll be a remnant of Jews saved. So when the end comes, and the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, every elect Gentile who will be saved has been saved. That's the end of time. By the time that happens, all Israel will be saved. Not the whole nation, all the elect. Time has run its course. The fullness of the Gentiles has come in. Not every Gentile, but a great number of them. The fullness of the Israelites has come in. Just the same, in parallel, not the whole number. This is a cumulative result. And so, by this means that I've been talking about, says the apostle, the remnant in every age, when you get to the end, and so, all Israel will be saved. The full number will be made up. All the remnants, totaled up. It'll be a much vaster number than we ever dreamed. And of Gentiles too. And then this will be in accordance with the promise of God. There shall come out of Zion the deliverer. When did that happen? That happened when Christ came out of Zion. Actually, Isaiah, from which the Apostle Paul very approximately quotes, says, there shall come to Zion. Or there shall come from Zion, from out of the church of Old Testament times, or to Zion, as Isaiah puts it, or for Zion, as some translates it. It's the coming of Christ. There shall come out of, or into, or for Zion, the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. In accordance with prophecy, when every remnant of Israel, all that have been gathered out, even through the gospel age, is finally made up, you'll see God has been faithful and has kept his promise. And he's always been saving Israelites as well as Gentiles. Gentiles are much more numerous, obviously. And it will be in accordance with the prophecy of Isaiah that Christ, who comes to Zion or out of Zion, will suffer and die and deliver, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. He will never abandon a remnant of Israelites. That's the meaning of the verse. It's not about, and then at the very end, the whole nation will suddenly be brought in. There may be a revival for reasons I've stated. But there's no word about the whole nation. But anyway, in this passage, and I've gone over time, we've seen the faithfulness of God. He never breaks his promises. His promise never was the whole nation. It was only ever the elect, right from the beginning, in real terms. We've seen the mercy of God. Even among the hardened, mercy is still shown. Astonishing kindness. We've seen the goodness of God. I hope that little exposition helps, dear friends. Let's close this morning singing the hymn number 608.